I'm Christopher Lydon with Lloyd Schwartz, a poet of plain speech made cheeky, musical, sometimes heartbreaking. This is our poetry series, Whose Words These Are, on Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. Lloyd Schwartz meant to be an actor. Along the way, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his newspaper coverage of classical music around Boston. But all the while, he's been a poet, typically in monologues and dialogues among people you can almost see on stage or in your kitchen. And all of his work is shaped by that sense, as his friend Robert Pinsky put it, that speaking is as natural as breathing. Lloyd Schwartz spoke and read for us where New England poets have been hanging out for most of a century, the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Cambridge. Lloyd Schwartz, there must have been a poem or a poet back there that drew you in.
Yeah. I was not very interested in poetry or English or literature until I was a senior in high school. I had a great English teacher in high school named Alan Canfer, who reminded me of Groucho Marx, had a mustache, probably the first man I ever met who wore a mustache, and who would do anything to get the class excited about poetry. I remember him leaping on his desk and reading the Dagger monologue from Macbeth. And I fell in love with poetry in his class. Poems suddenly meant something. They were actually about something. I felt they were about something. They were beautifully put together. I could see that. What a great teacher. And the two poems I remember being the very first poems that really got me excited about poems were Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn and Robert Frost's Fire and Ice. And I think they're both, one is a truly great poem. The Keats is certainly one of the greatest poems ever written in English, and maybe one of the two or three greatest poems about art itself. And then Fire and Ice was really about the world and people, and condensed into this sort of breathtaking and scary little poem that just exploded in my face. Fire and Ice by Robert Frost. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice.
A New Englander, if there ever was one.
Right.
Which reminds me,
yeah.
Put yourself in that sort of great chain of being. I mean, how many degrees of separation from those folks, from Homer, for that matter, in the case of Lloyd Schwartz?
Homer is good. I'm mainly a narrative poet, so I see myself in a tradition of narrative poetry, which I guess Homer started, as far as we know, and Chaucer, and monologues, character pieces, which I also write, and Frost, very much so, that irony in Fire and Ice is something that I think pervades, or that I hope pervades, my own poems. I'm a very... I think of myself as a very anti-sentimental poet. I have a low threshold for sentimentality, and I don't let my students get away with anything that I think is sentimental, and I try not to in my own work.
Leap right in. Give us one of those personal poems with a little of the Fire and Ice mischief and seriousness and cleverness in one.
I'll try. I hadn't really thought of this as a poem in that tradition, but I think maybe it is. Maybe it does come out of that. It's the first poem in my last book, and it's called A True Poem. I'm working on a poem that's so true, I can't show it to anyone. I could never show it to anyone, because it says exactly what I think, and what I think scares me. Sometimes it pleases me. Usually it brings misery. And this poem says exactly what I think. What I think of myself, what I think of my friends, what I think about my lover. Exactly. Parts of it might please them. Some of it might scare them. Some of it might bring misery. And I don't want to hurt them. I don't want to hurt them. I don't want to hurt anybody. I want everyone to love me. Still, I keep working on it. Why? Why do I keep working on it? Nobody will ever see it. Nobody will ever see it. I keep working on it, even though I can never show it to anybody. I keep working on it, even though someone might get hurt.
Reminds me of a question I've asked others. Do you write for yourself? Do you write for your audience? Do you write for editors? Do you write for God? Do you write for more, you know, do you write for the ages? Who's the audience for that poem?
Yeah, well, you know, the answer is really all of the above. And basically, for myself, it has to please me or work for me or scare me. And then, because I love reading poems aloud, and I love reading my own poems aloud, it's one of my favorite things to do.
And you do it so well, Lloyd. Would you give us the poem about yes and no, as I remember?
Happy to. It's called Six Words. It's a sestina, which is in a very particular mathematical form. And I would venture to say this is the world's shortest sestina. Six words. Yes, no, maybe, sometimes, always, never. Never? Yes. Always? No. Sometimes? Maybe. Maybe never sometimes. Yes, no, always, always, maybe, no, never, yes. Sometimes, sometimes, always, yes. Maybe, never. No, no, sometimes, never. Always, maybe. Yes, yes, no, maybe, sometimes, always, never.
Would anybody else know how to read it?
You know, that poem was set to music by a young composer, and she didn't know how to read it. It's a very interesting song, but it wasn't really the poem I had in mind.
Which reminds me, what's the community you work with? Who's your gang?
Who is...
What gang do you run with, Lloyd?
What gang do I run with? They'd be very amused to think of themselves in that way. Well, my Gail Mazur and Frank Bedard and Robert Pinsky, David Ferry, and some people who are not poets, who are very, just very close friends and who are very, very good and smart and sharp readers.
Lloyd, I want to hear more of your poems, but on the way, all-time favorite poem for a desert island, what would you want with you?
Oh.
In the spirit of the Pinsky favorite poem project.
Yeah. Probably Keats, maybe the Ode to a Nightingale. I think that's my favorite great poem, but maybe also... Andrew Marvels to his coy mistress because of the just the wonderful wit and passion and intensity, and maybe Elizabeth Bishop's In the Waiting Room.
Lloyd, what does an accomplished poet learn in editing a friend and idol, Elizabeth Bishop, for the Library of America?
How good she was in more ways than one would have expected. The poems themselves weren't such a surprise to me. She didn't write a whole lot of poems, and even the poems that she didn't publish, there really aren't so many, although there's some really marvelous ones, and I would actually love to read one of them. But also discovering this, what really very few people know about except the Bishop scholars is how much really marvelous prose she wrote. And that was the big discovery. That was the big discovery for me working on Elizabeth Bishop back to the time when I did a PhD thesis, my PhD thesis on her, and that also discovering that wealth of superlative prose. Robert Pinsky said in his book, The Situation of Poetry, he was talking about Bishop and about how her poems were not only great poems, but also had the great prose virtues that she could tell a story, she could give a narrative, and with great clarity and a kind of discursive clarity. But in the process of working on her poetry and her writing and getting to know her, I came across in a notebook that I was looking at, visiting her in the hospital, a poem that she had just finished, which I thought was wonderful and one of her great poems and a wonderful love poem. And I had to have a copy of it. And I made a copy for myself and kept it, hoping that she would eventually publish it, fearing that she might not because it was very personal. And she was a little reluctant to be too personal in her published work. And she died without having published it. And people have been going through her papers for many years and did not find the notebook that had that poem in it. So as far as I know, I had the only copy of that poem because I made a copy for myself. I copied it down.
Would you read it?
And I would love to read it. It's a wonderful poem, I think. It's called Breakfast Song. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue. I kiss your funny face, your coffee-flavored mouth. Last night I slept with you. Today I love you so. How can I bear to go as soon I must, I know, to bed with ugly death in that cold, filthy place, to sleep there without you, without the easy breath and night-long, limb-long warmth I've grown accustomed to. Nobody wants to die. Tell me it is a lie. But no, I know it's true. It's just the common case. There's nothing one can do. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue. Early and instant blue.
What a treasure to have rescued, Lloyd.
Yeah, I think so. if I accomplish nothing else in my life, saving, as I think of it, that poem was a very good thing to do, I think. And she seems to me a model of everything that good poetry should be. She said one of her most famous posthumous remarks. This was something that was discovered on a manuscript. It may have been discovered after she died. That she was talking about an essay that she never finished writing, talking about the qualities in other people's poetry that she loved. Mm. And they were accuracy, spontaneity, and mystery. Hmm. And I think she nailed it, and she was really describing her own work. Mm. That this, you know, this brilliant sense of detail and vivid description and the sense of absolutely living through a situation where you don't know what's going to happen next. And the poet herself doesn't even know what's going to happen next, so she corrects herself. She'll say, a church, no, I mean cathedral, in the process of the poem. And then the bottom line, or underneath the bottom line, this sense of complete mystery of how did this poem really, how did it come together? Why is it so deep? Why does it resonate so much? Why does it move us so much?
I'd love you to give us some of your own.
Thank you. I would love to.
New or classic?
Well, this is one of my own favorite of my own poems. And I wrote a series of poems about my mother. My mother died several years ago. She was 100 when she died and had been seriously losing her memory for the last 10 years of her life. But my mother would do anything for me, and I don't think she knew that she was giving me poems and giving me subjects for poems. And a number of these poems are based very closely on things that she said. I'm going to read a poem that's entirely in her voice. And it's called The Two Horses, A Memory. You said you had lunch in Pittsfield. Was it on North Street? That reminds me of when we lived on the farm. It must be 80 years ago. We went to a one-room schoolhouse. Didn't you drive past it once? Each row was a different grade. I sat in the first seat of the first row. The teacher's name was Miss Brown. She was so pretty. I wonder if she's still alive. The day before we left the farm, our cat disappeared. We couldn't find her anywhere. I was sad for weeks. 3 months later, she showed up at our new house in Pittsfield. Robbins Avenue. I can't think of the number now. My sister was in New York. She didn't like the people she was living with, so she'd visit us. She fell in love with the young man who lived next door. Morris. Your uncle, Morris. They got married and moved to Cleveland. They're both gone now, aren't they? You know, I can't picture her. A few years later, we moved to New York. This just jumped into my mind. I must have been 3 years old. We were still in Russia, Mir, a small town, but famous for its yeshiva. My oldest brother, Joe, took our horses down to the river. They were the two best horses in the town. My father had a phaeton, a beautiful old buggy. He was like a taxi driver. He took people to Minsk or Vilna. That day he was at the station, the passenger station, waiting for customers. My brother was still just a kid. He must have been washing the horses in the river. I can remember. It was a hot day. Maybe he was giving them a drink. And while I was watching, the reins got caught around a pole in the river. The horses kept twisting the reins around that pole. It was slippery. The reins kept sliding down under the water, and they were pulling the horses down with them. I ran into town and got my father, who came running back with a knife in his teeth. He jumped into the river with all his clothes on. He took the knife and sawed away at the reins until he finally cut through. He saved the horses. I haven't thought about this in 1,000 years. It's like a dream. You get up, it's forgotten. Then it all comes back. Didn't I ever tell you? Look at me. I'm starting to cry. What's there to cry about? Such an old, old memory. Why should it make me cry?
Oh, Lloyd, that's so beautiful.
Oh, thank
so
you.
Sad, so sweet. So much like my mother.
Yeah, right. Right.
The last stories that sort of are coughed up.
Yeah. I mean, it was a story I never heard when I was a kid. My mother had lots of stories, but I never heard that until really just a couple of years before she died, and when she wasn't remembering anything, and then she'd have these flashes of a whole world of memory coming back to her, especially very old memories.
Is there a formal structure to that poem?
There is, but it's not a very conventional one. It's one that I've kind of gravitated to in a lot of my poems. The true poem is in the same quote-unquote form, and it's short sentences, and each sentence is its own stanza. So it's free verse, and I think of it as a poem. It's not prose to me. It feels organized like a poem, but the lines are sentences, are short sentences rather than, and the stanzas are short sentences. So each sentence is its own stanza. It's as if each new thought were, you know, stanza means a room. It's a word for room in Italian. So it's as if each line, each stanza is like going into a sort of new place, into a different room.
Take us to another room.
Take us
a new room.
A new room. This is a poem called Nostalgia, The Lake at Night. The black water. Lights dotting the entire perimeter. Their shaky reflections. The dark tree line, the plap-plapping of water around the pier, creaking boats, the creaking pier. Voices in conversation, in discussion, two men, adults, serious inflections, the words themselves just out of reach. A rusty screen door spring, then the door swinging shut. Footsteps on a porch. The scrape of a wooden chair. Footsteps shuffling through sand. Animated, youthful voices. How many? Distinct, disappearing. A sudden guffaw. Some giggles. A woman's, no, a young girl's sarcastic reply. Someone's assertion. A high-pitched male cackle. Somewhere else, a child laughing. Bug zappers. Tires whirring along a pavement, not stopping, receding. Shadows from passing headlights. a cat's eyes caught in a headlight. No moon. Connect the dot constellations filling the black sky, the ladle of the Big Dipper not quite directly overhead. The radio tower across the lake, signaling. Muffled quacking near the shore, a frog belching, crickets, cicadas, katydids, etc., their relentless sexual messages. A sudden gust of wind, branches brushing against each other, pine, beech, a fiberglass hull tapping against the dock, a sudden chill, the smell of smoke, wood stove fires, a light going out, a dog barking, then more barking from another part of the lake, a burst of quiet laughter, someone in the distance calling someone too loud, steps on a creaking porch, a screen door spring, the door banging shut, another light going out, you must have just undressed for bed. My bare feet on the splintery pier, turning away from the water.
Sort of an emotional time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
Detail, narrative,
detail.
Suggestion. Let me ask a simple question. simple-minded question. How did those images come to you, and when? Were you compiling? Were you saving them for months? Did it come quickly?
That one, I really had this very kind of overwhelming and almost magical experience standing at the edge of a lake. And I started writing that right away. Other poems, there's no pattern. I wish there were. I wish I could predict what's gonna happen next.
Lloyd, in the Massachusetts Poetry Festival connection, we're just thinking very widely about the vitality, the quality, the variety, the community of poets around here, in New England, in this hood, so to speak, but in this age, the age of Obama, yeah, of the web, of the internet, of anything, yeah, the digital age. If you had to give a report to Mars or to Shakespeare or to Ovid about the state of their art in our time, where would... If they asked, how's poetry doing where you live, Lloyd Schwartz, what's the answer?
It's great. It's great. There's so many good poets. There's so many interesting poets. There's so many poets who are different from one another. I mean, I think that maybe that's one of the things that's a little bewildering to a... to an audience that isn't in the middle of that world, that you hear, you know, five poets read and what do they have in common aside from the English language? And yet there is this vitality, there is this there's a wonderful kind of colloquialness and in various degrees. Poets seem to be talking to us, not just pontificating or, you know, or chanting, although there's some of that too. And there are a lot of very good poets around, and they're working hard and being very different from one another and being true to their own inner voices. I mean, all these cliches that...
People worry so much about publication and books and the poem in hand. What are the compensating stimulations? What's the offsetting energy in the poetry world?
Well, people still want to be published, and I heard some very sad news a few days ago that one of our most distinguished quarterlies, Tri-Quarterly, one of the best literary magazines in the country, is going to stop publishing in book form and to go directly online. And the editor is resigning. the most, I mean, we're sitting here in the Grolier bookshop surrounded by these marvelous books that you can hold in your hand and turn the pages. And I would profoundly miss that. But people are still reading poems, and there are a lot of good poems are published online, too. It seems to me more and more people, maybe this is the last 20 years or maybe even longer, going back to the, you know, to the beat poets, where reading poems aloud to an interested and appreciative audience has become a real force in the poetry world, and it's incredibly gratifying if it's something you like to do, which I do.
Indulge us in a version of the Proust questionnaire, Lloyd. What talent would you most love to have that you don't?
I would have been an actor. I was an actor for a while, and I'm sorry I'm not acting, which is probably one of the reasons that I write monologues, character pieces. But that was my great ambition, and I miss it. I did it for a while, and I still miss it.
Who's your ideal artist in another medium?
Gotta say Shakespeare. Gotta say Rembrandt. But also Vermeer.
Who do people think you are when you walk down the street?
Some old guy with a lot of gray hair.
How many people in the subway would recognize you as a poet?
Almost none. But people say, oh, that guy looks like he's a professor.
What's the keynote of your personality as a poet?
I would like people to think honesty and a sense of humor.
What's the quality you most love in a poem?
Immediacy. I want to be moved. I want to be in the world that the poet is writing about.
What's your motto?
I'm up for anything.
Good. That's good. Lloyd Schwartz, thank you so much for your reading, for your work, for your being a great institution in this town.
Thanks, Chris. You too.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Lloyd Schwartz. Our Brown University interns, Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson, studied up with us and helped find a way through all the words. Thanks to the Grolier Poetry Bookshop for making a sort of studio between their shelves. Also to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival for helping us round up the poets. Thanks to listeners who leave a comment or a poem at our website, radioopensource.org. And thanks to all for joining the conversation. I'm Christopher Leiden.